Good afternoon. So, last time, we finished up talking about mMap, which was this feature of POSIX where you could put a file into your memory. And we mentioned that Linux made this choice that, well, that's how they decided they were going to manage a program's memory, is that they kind of treat it as a list of mMap calls that were made. That's what they track. And they'd have some special cases to deal with. Well, not all memory has a file associated with it, so they'd have the special case that an mMap would have no associated file. And we had this kind of unifying idea of treating memory as what we called a page cache. That virtual pages sort of and files, regular files, are, really on disk. And for things which don't have, a file name, we'll just make up a location on disk for them. And the physical pages are just going to cache copies of that data on disk. And we're just going to have to think about how do we manage what we keep in that cache in the OS. And that is decisions about when do we replace something in the cache with something else? How do we track where things are so we can, find something when a program asks to read or tries to access some memory location, and so we can actually perform that replacement when we need to remove something from the sort of forward mappings. We also mentioned that mMap embraces this copy-on-write idea, and that one feature it supports is these private mappings, where reading is loaded from the file on demand, but it makes a copy on write, and that copy kind of is treated as far as what happens after the write, like one of those unbacked mappings that will save it to disk if we need to in some other location, because it's private, we aren't supposed to modify the file. And it turns out that if you look at, say, programs on Linux, when they load the program from disk, they use this mechanism, which has the effect that the program is kind of loaded on demand, that even though conceptually we're copying all the code of the program into memory, actually what's happening internally is the equivalent of this private mMap call that's going to set that up to be loaded later on. And if the program modifies initial values of variables and things like that in there, that's not going to change the executable file it was loaded from. Then we started looking at, since we know we have this page cache, that we want to manage these physical pages that are caching parts of our program's memory and parts of files on disk, how do we choose what to replace? And we started with this idea that we're going to optimize the number of replacements, and we're going to assume a reactive strategy, that we're not going to do anything unless the program, or programs, I should say, try to access something. But when they do, what is the best we can possibly do in terms of the number of times we'll have to bring something into our cache? That is, bring something into physical memory. And we saw that the optimal algorithm for this was Blady's min. And the statement of how it works is simple. We look for the thing that's accessed furthest in the future. That's what's replaced. Now, the problem is that this kind of assumes we know what's going to happen in the future, and that isn't really true. We can't actually do that. So we started talking about sort of realistic approximations, and the big one we're going to use is least recently used, which is what I'll continue talking about next, but first questions about things we covered last time. One question, can I go over number 4 on the quiz? So I need to remember. What number 4 on the quiz was? Okay, so on the quiz, we were saying that we had a program with had this layout, and what happened is that it forked, and then these, it forked and these writes happened. And because we're forking, we're going to implement copy on write here. So, it's asking after that, how many physical pages will be accessible by the program? So let's just consider what's going to be the case after step one. Nothing else to start out with. So in that case, we have 2 pages of code. We have 1 page of global variables. And immediately after fork, well, there haven't been any changes. So they're going to be the same in the parent and child, so they can share the same physical page. When one of them modifies one of them, we can't do that anymore. So we have 3 pages of code, 2 pages of global variables, 1 page of heap, and 1 page of stack. And so initially, that's 3 plus 2, 5, 6, 7 pages. And then the parent process writes some stuff to the stack. Now, there are 2 writes here, but only the first one's actually going to trigger a page fault, because when that happens, we're going to make a copy for the parent of this range of memory. Why this whole range? Because that's a whole page. We can't do less than a page. So even though we might like to only copy the 8 bytes the parent is writing, we can't do that, because once we give the parent that copy, we have to give it a whole page in order to do that. We can't just give it that 8 bytes as, you know, and still have it share the rest. And then when the child process writes to the heap, we're going to need to make a copy of that for the child. So that's another page, and this is 1 page, so we're going to copy the whole page. We can't do less than that. And when the parent writes to the heap, you might say, oh, we need to make another copy for the parent. And maybe we would, but after we do that, you know, we still have 2 copies accessible. So we don't actually need to make a copy for 5, because, well, the parent is already the only user of the original. But even if we did, you know, make a copy, then we want to throw away the original and we'd still have just 2 copies in existence. So there's a question, why, when the parent writes to the stack here, does it require a page fault? Why is it read-only? And the reason it's read-only is because if we allow the parent to write here without making a copy first, then when the child reads from its stack, it's going to read the wrong value. And we can't allow that. So we need to do something to stop that after step two. If the child process read from its stack, it needs to still read the old value, not the modified value. So the question is, you know, I think in what was confusing in my examples, I had the child write first, but there was nothing different about the child and parent page tables immediately after forking in our examples. So we have to have the same issue happen if the parent writes first. But I had to choose one of the programs to write first in my prior examples, and I chose the opposite of what I chose in this quiz question. So I think that's what was causing this confusion. So then, asking you to go over 1 and 2. So for 1 and 2, we're making this mmap call, where we ask to map part of a file and we write to a little bit of it. And since we're getting here, we're writing to FF8 to FF8 plus OX30. And this is going to span 2 pages because this is, you know, going to, 0 through FFF is going to be the first page of the file that's mapped. So we're going to get the end of the first page and the beginning of the second. So that means that in order to load this on demand, we're going to have to load the first page on demand when we access I equals FFF8. And we're going to have to load the second page on demand when I becomes 1000, the beginning of the second page of the mapping. And when we load the file, well, we have to give a whole page to the program. All we can do as the OS is set a whole page table entry. And so that means that, you know, we're going to have to load the whole page because we won't be informed, you know, if there was code after this that says tries to access index 0. We won't know that. It's just going to work and get a value. So if we don't load the value from index 0 of the file, we could break this program. And the same is true for other parts of the second page. And that's why we got this size, which is two whole pages. Okay, so I will go to questions on 3 in a bit that I see have queued up, but questions on 1 and 2. Okay, so not so in 2, if the 1 and 2. So questions on 3 and 4. So we have a question. So question 3 and 4 here. Let me make sure I got it in here. So a question, if the child, I assume in this question, writes to the stack, will it need to create a new page table? So when we fork, typically, we're going to create a new page table right away. Technically, we could avoid that, but it's generally not worthwhile. It's just that the two page tables of the parent and child are initially going to have the same contents, but that's going to change very quickly when either of them, you know, modifies any part of their memory. And a question, if the child writes to the stack after the parent writes to the stack, so say between 3 and 4 here, we had the child writing to the stack, would that occur a new page fault? And this depends on what the implementation of this page fault handler is. So one thing we could potentially do is on this page fault, we could update both the parent and child's page table to make it writable. Another thing we could do is we could just update the parent page table to make it writable and figure out when the child writes to the stack whether we need to make a copy or not. And that second strategy is by far more common just because it's less complicated to implement. And, well, yes, you have an extra page fault, but that's a very quick page fault. And especially on a multi-core system, updating the page table might be complicated because you have to, like, lock things and make sure you're going to behave correctly if that other program is running in parallel. Okay, and a question, is there going to be partial credit for number 4? So we are a TA will definitely be reading the comments for this. I may consider if their assessment is that we probably need to, that there's a common misconception that results in a particular answer, we might change the key depending on how that looks. There's definitely partial credit if there's like a comment explaining something you're not sure about, but as far as generally, I might consider doing off by one as partial credit if I didn't already, depending on whether it looks like people are usually getting that answer for a reason that's not like guessing. And a question on 2, is there partial credit for writing this in decimal? Yeah, we'll do something about that. that's on the quiz. So other questions, so comments about things we covered last time or other questions before I move on to today's material? Okay, so last time we introduced this least recently used policy. And this is a practical policy. It doesn't result in the same replacements as, you know, Belady's Min, but it's often pretty close. So, you know, for example, when we're accessing, you know, so, well, here it happens to be the same as Belady's Min, but we can see that, you know, there's cases like here where, you know, we do not get the same answer. And usually when this happens, well, the reason why is because our access pattern doesn't follow this rule, but this sort of assumption that if we access something now, we're likely to access it again soon. If we think about when we access A, does that mean we're accessing A again soon? Well, no, because we're going to access everything else before we access A again in this pattern. But you might observe that this is like actually a kind of realistic thing that happens sometimes. So LRU, there are real cases where, you know, in real programs where it's going to perform badly, but most of the time we don't have access patterns that look like this. So it's good. So let's, you know, look at how LRU works to make sure we understand what's going on. So I have an access pattern here. I'd like to figure out what happens in LRU. And well, again, these are my virtual pages. I'm labeling A through C, A through D, and I have three slots, three physical pages I'm going to put them in. And my first question is here. So what do we want to replace for this access to C? So the question, is this the same as least recently used cache replacement in 3030? Assuming that's what you mean by cache replacement, yes. This is least recently the same as the policy we use for cache replacement. But unlike processor caches, we have in a real system, you know, not like three slots, but like 1,000. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on B, which is the correct answer, but a bunch of you want to use A. And so this is where I should probably be distinguished between two policies. So least recently used, we have to know what used means. And used is read or written or loaded. So it includes any type of use. And that's probably the confusion. So the answer would be A in a different policy, which is known as FIFO. So first in, first out. Out, which you can kind of think of as least recently loaded. Yeah. And this is not a crazy policy, and it turns out it's way easier to implement than LRU, so there are real systems which use it, because, like, way easier, incredibly easier to implement than LRU. So this is, FIFO would choose A here because it was loaded first, but that's not what LRU means. LRU is use includes all sorts of use. And you might be thinking, wait a moment, how do we figure out in the OS that A was accessed after B was loaded? And that is indeed a big problem that we're going to talk about. And that's going to be a reason why this is not going to be the real policy we're going to see implemented in OSs. it's going to be something kind of like this, but we aren't going to actually do exactly these replacements. But we're going to try to do better than this FIFO policy. So given that, if we do that replacement, and apologies that apparently I thought I could keep my windows open and not be disturbed by loud planes. If we do that, then the next time we need a replacement is here. So, oh, nope, I skipped one. Darn it. Well, I kind of gave away the answer, but maybe you weren't looking. Oops. So here we want to look at, we need to put B in somewhere, and we just removed it. So this is a case where, you know, LRU made a mistake. But that's sort of the LRU assumption. And if you think of, like, why did we do it? Well, because B wasn't accessed recently relative to other things. So we made that mistake. And now A is the most recently used thing. So now, question is, for the last part, what is A going to replace? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that it's B. And that's because, we have our choices are D, which was just accessed, C, which was accessed before that, and B, of all our choices, the least recently used part. So that's what we're going to choose. Okay, so you see what LRU does. You might say, how can we implement it? Well, it's pretty straightforward to implement in software. So commonly you maintain a doubly linked list of your pages. Why a doubly linked list? Because it turns out we're going to want to move things in the list. And when a page is accessed, so you have your linked list of pages, and you have, our head and our tail. When a page is accessed, say in the middle, we are going to move it to the top, remove it from the list and move it to the top of the list. So that's sort of the most straightforward way of implementing it. Now, the problem is that though this is, sort of conceptually straightforward, there's a big practical issue, which is that we want to do a linked list operation on every single memory access. And that's just not practical. That's going to probably take a lot longer than that. Because remember, a memory access is like writing a value to a string. That's an access. So we want every write to a string also changes a linked list. So that's just not going to be practical. So we can technically do this, but we're going to have to do some approximation because this slowdown is just not acceptable. And what we want to think about is, well, if we can't like run code every time a page is accessed because that's just way too slow, what can we do to detect accesses? And our key insight is that, well, we don't actually need to know about every access. The important part about the least recently used policy is that we exclude recent pages from replacement. That we aren't going to care about getting the precise order right, but when we have 1,000 pages, we just want to not choose one of, say, the 100 most recent. You know, that's where our big win is going to be. That getting the order between the 10th and the 11th most recent exactly right is not something we're going to care about. We just want to get sort of the broad strokes right. And if we only care about it, what is it accessed recently, then we can maintain this information without running code on every access. And we can detect these accesses sort of in a more gentle way. So one strategy for implementing this is that we can kind of test whether a page is being used. That we can mark it invalid in the page table. And when a page fault happens, we can say, yes, it's being used. And, well, this has a cost, right? We're adding extra page faults that seemingly were unnecessary. But it's not so bad because we're only going to have to do it occasionally. We're not going to do this for every access, but maybe like every 100,000 or million accesses will have one of these page faults to record, yes, it was being accessed. So this strategy sort of is, you know, a way we can do this. And operating systems want to do this so often that actually the hardware often helps out. So for example, on x86 and many other architectures, but not all of them, there's actually a bit in the page table that is set by the hardware in this kind of way. That basically, if the page is not already marked as accessed, and a program uses a page table entry to access it, that page table entry is marked as accessed so the OS can figure out, yes, it was used since I last looked at that bit. So this is all detecting accesses in sort of a time window, where that time window is either since we marked the page as invalid or since we last checked that bit that the hardware is going to set to 1 when the program accesses things. Question is, can I give examples of other architectures which use this? I would need to look things up carefully to like give a good list. And a reason why this is complicated is because like I suspect some ARM systems do it, but ARM systems actually vary in their page table formats. I would need to look some up, but I know that this is a common strategy. Sort of the intuition for whether an architecture does this hardware support is that things that are less risk-like are more likely to have this feature. So a question is, when we have this hardware access bit being set, does it get zeroed after a certain amount of time? And the answer is the hardware won't do that, but the OS can zero it out periodically to know that it wants to scan for accesses now. So a strategy an OS might use is it will scan the reference bits, and we'll see this in a second, setting them to zero as it scans them, and then see if they get set to 1 at some later time. Or just remember to check, you know, in a few seconds, did this get referenced since I last checked the bit. But, you know, managing when to check these bits is the job of the OS, even with the hardware supports. So this is a way we can detect sort of accesses, and this is sort of read or write. And reads includes executing. We also can apply the same idea if we're detecting writes. So kind of not going to talk about it much as far as these replacement policies because it doesn't help us approximate LRU that much. But remember that we have to write modify data out to disk. So we have to know like if a program modified a file through a shared mapping or modified a file, you know, something that was loaded from its executable that it needs to run, like that contains a global variable. Well, how do we do that? So there's the same idea we can apply to record what's often called a dirty bit, where either the hardware will help us and set that in our page table entry, and we check it to figure out, oh, was this page written to? And if so, I need to save it. Or we can mark the page as read-only and track that information ourselves in the same way. So questions about these accessed or dirty bits? So question is, the dirty bits checks for write recently. So if we clear the dirty bit, yes, that would be a way of checking, was it written to recently? When we have this hardware support. Okay, so since we have this idea of a reference bit, either set by hardware or by software, set by software by marking the page as invalid and recording it, in an OS data structure, or set by the hardware in the page table, we can have a simple policy that is based on doing this, using this, and this is a policy I'll call second chance. And what we'll have is we'll have an ordered list of physical pages. And our hope is that this order kind of approximately matches the least recently used order. And an easy approximation is every time sort of a page is replaced, like we add it to the top of the list, and the bottom of the list should be the least recently used thing a lot of the time, but not always. So our strategy here is that pages at the top of the list, we're going to start as marking as not referenced. So not accessed. And we're going to set that bit. We're going to check that bit when they get to the bottom of the list. And if the page was referenced, we're going to give it a second chance to prove that it's not being used. Otherwise, we're going to assume, it was being used soon, recently, So our goal is to, only choose pages to evict that weren't accessed recently. And our notion of accessed recently is that it wasn't accessed in the time from when we put it on the top of this list until it went, when it made its way to the bottom. And the reason I call this second chance is that basically any page that was referenced in the time since it got to the top of the list, gets a second chance before it gets evicted. So questions about this idea? I'm going to go through an example so we can look at how it works sort of more practically. Okay. So a question, this OS model doesn't have the intentional faults. So here I'm talking about having referenced, or we could also call them access bits. And these could be bits that are set by the hardware, or it could be the case that when we start a page at the top of this list, we mark it as invalid in the page table. And when it gets accessed, we mark it as valid, and that's what we're checking for. Either way, we can use the same policy. So let's look at how this works. So we have our list of pages, and I have here this physical page number. And again, like my previous example, the virtual pages I'll represent using letters, the physical pages I'll represent using numbers. And we have a list of physical pages and whether they have been referenced since they've been on this list. And sort of I have an initial state where all our pages are available and haven't been referenced because, well, they're not being used for anything. And then I want to bring in A, and what's going to happen is, well, I'm going to take A from the bottom of the list. I'm going to say, has it been referenced? No, it hasn't. Doesn't need a second chance. And I'm going to put A in it and add it to the top of the list because it's a new page. And then after I finish handling that page fault, the access to A is going to happen, and it's going to mark that page as referenced. So then we access B in physical page 2. Sorry, I meant to 2. And, you know, we're using the thing at the end of the list, not referenced. We can put B there, and B, again, immediately becomes referenced. So you see this sort of pattern that sort of the first time we put a page on the list, well, it kind of always gets referenced. And that makes sense, right? Because immediately after we load it, of course, we're accessing it. So the interesting case is when something makes it to the top of the list later on from not being referenced. So on future slides, there's these intermediate steps here. I'm going to skip on future slides just to save space. So let's sort of go through, you know, extending our example. So now let's say we want to access D here. And we need to place it in one of these three physical pages. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the thing at the end of the list. So that's the thing that was added furthest ago. And we're going to see, well, it's referenced, so it gets a second chance. And then we're going to look at the next thing there because, well, we couldn't use one and it's referenced, so it also gets a second chance. And the same is going to happen with three. It gets a second chance. But in this case, well, you know, after we've done that, it turns out that, well, one is at the bottom of the list again. Sorry, you just made it all the way there. And this time, it's not going to get a second chance. So this is going to be a time where we replace it with D. So questions about how this how we chose D here. Chose D is going in, you know, physical page 1. Okay. So after we insert D, it became referenced because we immediately access it, and then we access B. And this access to B is going to set that reference bit that we kind of just reset for accessing B, for putting D in. Because we were scanning through the list, we said, oh, these all things were all referenced. So, you know, I'm going to give them a second chance and it turned out that the first thing, you know, was what we chose. So then let's say we have an access here to A. The question is, so did we have to go over the entire list resetting the reference bits before we put in D? Yes. And we have to do that because our policy is when we pull something on the list, if it's marked as reference, we don't use it. We put it back on the list without, you know, replacing that page yet. The question is, what does the asterisk mean? That's just marking where there are changes to the reference bits. And I did not explain that earlier. Sorry about that. I guess I should say the asterisk marking where there are changes to the reference bits without moving things around in the list. Okay, so give another 15 seconds. You seem to have pretty good consensus on at least what gets replaced. Okay, so majority of you say that C is what we're going to put in, and that is indeed what happened. So we'll set this up here. So we're accessing A here. So we're going to take the bottom thing off the list, and it's reference. So it gets a second chance. And that means that we need to look at the next thing on the list, which is 3 here. And it's not referenced. It hasn't been used since we reset it as part of finding a place to put D. And so it, page 3, that's going to be where we end up inserting A. And that ends up replacing C. And after we insert A, page 1 is at the bottom of the list. It's not the next thing we're going to replace if nothing happens, because it's referenced, but it's at the bottom of the list. So questions about how I got this answer? Okay, so let's do our last step here. Give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so among those who answered, we have pretty good consensus that B is what happens, and sort of our procedure is that we look at 1 here, and we give it a second chance because it was referenced. Then we look at 2, and this is what we actually replace. And it ends up that we have physical page 3 at the end of our list afterwards. Now, we're not going to immediately replace it because when we access the list next, we're going to say, oh, this deserves a second chance. That's sort of an idea. So questions about this second chance idea? So the question is, what's the overhead for access? So this sort of, these small examples are kind of bad at showing sort of what the typical overhead looks like. But a notable thing is that, you know, if the program was executing a bunch, say, at this point, accessing A, B, and C, or, you know, A and C over and over again, for example, that would not incur any overhead. It's only when we need to replace something that we actually end up doing a lot of work here. Because otherwise, we're just doing the little teeny bit of work of recording this reference bit, which we only have to do once until the next replacement. So if replacements aren't frequent, the overhead's very low, which is a huge contrast to least recently used. Now, the main concern is that when we have a replacement, it could, like in this example here, take a very long time because we have to scan through this long list. So when we're talking about sort of practical variants of this, that's going to be something we want to avoid. Is that, you know, we don't want to do that long scan through a list, figuring out everything needs a second chance. And kind of a problem with this is that, you know, we're kind of looking at things that might have been referenced a very long time ago, and we'd like to avoid that. We'd like to kind of not care about references that happened, you know, minutes ago, but with, you know, a terabyte of memory, well, that's probably going to happen. So I'm going to talk about briefly sort of a variation on this that kind of avoids this compromise. And this is something that is called Seek. This is a Linux replacement policy. So this is actually what Linux uses for non-file pages, for pages without a backing file. And what they did instead is they have this idea of, let's have an ordered list of pages and kind of try to give pages a second chance, but they instead divided things into two lists. So they have one list, this inactive list, and that's where they're doing the second chance idea, that there's this list of pages that when they're on this list, if they get referenced, we're going to remove them from this list, but if they don't, these are the pages we're going to actually evict. So basically, we're doing something kind of similar to second chance as far as when pages make it on this list, but rather than when they get referenced, moving them to the top of the list again, we have this separate list called the active list, which is also where we start new pages of things we assume have been accessed kind of recently. And it's only when things stay on the active list for a while that we guess that they might not be being used. And we basically give them as much time as it takes to get from the top of this inactive list to the bottom to prove that they're being used. And if they are, we just move them back to the active list. And sort of the advantage over second chance is that, you know, we can adjust the size of this inactive list to kind of change our sensitivity as far as how long ago will an access matter or not, and also to avoid extra overhead from setting and or checking reference bits, that we're only going to be checking reference bits for things in this list. So if we manage the size of this, we can manage our overhead in addition to managing sort of how sensitive we are to that. So question, isn't the inactive list an extension of the active list? So yes, you can kind of look at it that way, that like it kind of looks like it's one big list, but we've said that this inactive part of the list, this is the part where we care about things being referenced. Otherwise, we don't care. So something I guess maybe should be explicit, we're going to, you know, clear reference bits as we move things from the active to an active list. So we're only going to look for references while it's inactive. Well, where inactive means while we're guessing that it's not being used, so we put it on this list of inactive pages. Even though, you know, that's not always going to be right, but that's okay, because as long as it gets used, we'll figure that out. Okay. And as I mentioned, this is actually what Linux uses for non-file pages. The algorithm for, you know, parts of files is very similar, but has a tweak that we'll, you know, allude to in a bit. And this idea of sort of, you know, just scanning the reference bits kind of deliberately in smaller time scales, which is another way of viewing what's happening here, is that rather than checking if it's referenced in the time it takes to go from the top of the active list to the bottom of the inactive list, we're only checking the smaller time scale. Sort of generally, there's this whole family of sort of replacement algorithms where, you know, you do something akin to record if it's referenced periodically, and like you have that history, and you can make whatever choice you like. And you, we can kind of view these as, they're often called clock algorithms, because a common view is that, like, we can think of like moving the hand of a clock to that will point to what page we're checking the reference bit of, and then we look at these histories of reference bits to decide what replacement we actually make. And we can think of this as kind of a generalization of policies like this, where we can make sort of whatever adjustment to sensitivity we want. But we can see from Linux choosing this that, you know, Linux had did not feel it was actually useful to have like this sort of actual history. They just keep, you know, one bit of information essentially. So the question is, does the dot, dot, dot imply there are 8 last reference bits total? So by the last reference bits, I mean that basically we are, that this page has a reference bit, which is the current reference bit, which might be, say, Y, and this is what it was, you know, copy of reference bit from, you know, X sex ago, and this is from X plus 1 sex ago, and so on. That this is sort of a history of the real reference bit, is what this clock idea is. And depending on what we're trying to do, we could keep as much or as little of this history as we wanted. And we might keep it in another format, like we might just have like a counter or something like that. But I'm just saying there's this whole universe of possible policies that are kind of extensions of this. But typically, you know, we have some very, you know, simple idea that just does a little bit better than second chance, like what Linux is doing. Okay, so we talked about these policies, which are all about approximating L or U. And this, you know, and we found that, you know, we can get very close to LRU, you know, as long as we're just detecting recent accesses. So this is like looking for, was it accessed recently? If so, let's not evict it. Let's put it back on the list of things not to evict. And, you know, this works very well in cases where LRU, if we could implement it perfectly, would do well. Well, those other policies will also do very well.
Didn't add this exercise, did I? No, I didn't. Huh. That's unfortunate of me. So I guess we'll do this without a poll. So let's think, here's a list of things that LRU might be bad for. I'll take your, anyone want to make a case for any of the LRU being bad for any of these? Take in the chat.
So one is arguing that these movie examples, because what we just accessed, since recent usage is not, you know, future usage. And sort of a key reason why, you know, if we think of movies on the desktop, well, we aren't going to actually access that thing again. And so this we can consider sort of a scanning pattern. And that seems problematic. It's less clear how problematic it is for the web server, but we sort of have the same kind of problem that, you know, the thing we definitely want to access next is not what we just accessed, you know. But it might be the case that some other, that because we have multiple people on a web server using the movies, that maybe we'd get some reuse there. So any other examples which seem bad for LRU? And this is sort of the key intuition you want to think about, you know, is what's being accessed recently not what we're going to access again soon? You know, for a movie we're playing once, yeah, we're not going to access the beginning of the movie again. So, one inquiry is that here is a frequently requested HTML file saying, you know, wouldn't least frequently used be a better policy? And the answer is maybe. But LRU still does okay, because LRU and least frequently used is very close, you know. So this least frequently used might be better, but LRU will be close to LFU. They'll be similar in the kind of results they give. So LRU, you know, it might not be the best policy for this, but it's at least not going to be horrible. So someone's saying that the initial value is because they're new accesses. So this is, I think, questionable. But I think if you think of a global variable, probably it gets used again multiple times. So once. So this seems probably actually fine, assuming that, like, not every single global variable gets immediately written to and, like, we actually need a copy. You know, or if you think about it, you know, if we start shells a lot, which might happen. You say on, like, portal, shells will start a lot of the time. Then it's still useful, even if, you know, we're changing things. So question, how are out of disk space errors handled with the cache? So as far as the page cache, let's say we want to save something to disk and we don't have space to do that. That's a big problem. And typically the strategy for that is that we're going to reserve space on disk in advance. But if you're writing a new file, of course, you know, that's what I'm talking about here, is that the text editor is like doing a write, and the write returns, sorry, there's no disk space. And probably, like, there's no disk space on, like, the external disk you're on or something. So there's one proposal that another example that seems bad for LRU is the second to last one, because the values that are loaded are going to be not used in the future, right? That what we're going to load, we're not actually going to ever use again. We're going to replace with something else. Reused. So having it, seeing that it's loaded, tells us in fact that it's never going to be used again. So an argument is that for this code that for handling out of disk space errors is bad because they're rare. So I think that LRU is actually pretty good for this. And my argument is that, well, yes, you're right, it's rare. But hopefully that means that usually it's not going to be recently used. And we should think about, well, when it is used, does that mean it's more likely to happen again soon? And I think often the answer might be yes, because if we're out of disk space now, we're likely to be out of disk space when you if you try to like write the file again immediately afterwards. So I think it's actually okay for this scenario, but I understand the argument that maybe if we're getting out of disk space error once, it's never going to happen again. So maybe it's bad. So question, would a question like this be on a quiz? Not something that is quite this open-ended. Because, yeah, there's some subjectivity here. So the question is, would the movies reuse ever reuse cache pages? So the desktop example, I agree, would not. The web server example might, because they're multiple users. And they could be, you know, close together in the movie. Okay. So, sort of a big thing we've seen where LRU does poorly is when we're reading things exactly once or when we're scanning large amounts of data. And this is actually a big concern for OSs because... if we're thinking about files, these are both common ways that files are accessed. It's very common for files to be read and then, you know, loaded into a data structure in memory. And then when they're written out, like they're written out entirely. For example, this is how most, say, you know, word processors work. Is that they load the whole file into memory and then write the whole thing out. It's also sort of common for, like, you know, playing movies, or if we're processing very large files, well, we probably don't load it into memory, but if we have, like, a, you know, 100 gigabyte file, our program is probably going to read over that whole file all at once and not, like, read over little bits of it in a way where LRU would be helpful. And... so this is a concern and a reason why, if you look at, for example, what Linux does, Linux doesn't actually use an LRU policy for file accesses. It does something that is sort of LRU with exceptions. And basically the exceptions that Linux makes is it has this heuristic, it's a guess, where it tries to detect when file data is being accessed just once in one of these sort of scan-like patterns, and exempt that from being considered a recent use, but make the other uses of file data be considered recent. So there's another thing that looking at... These common patterns here we can think about, and that's revisiting an assumption I made when I introduced this page replacement idea that we just load things on demand. And we can do better than that. We can sort of be proactive, and this is something that most OSs do. And sort of the intuition is, well, let's say you see a program accesses page 4 of a file, so you need to load it in, then page 5, then page 6. Well, it's a pretty good guess that the program's also going to access page 7. Is that 100% right? No. But it's right so often that it's a very good idea for the OS to make that guess and read the file before the program accesses it, load it into memory, avoid waiting when the program gets there, you know, do it in advance. And this idea is called read-ahead, where the idea is the OS is going to look at what the program is accessing and say, yeah, let me just get ahead of you. So by the time you actually get to page 7, it's already loaded. So thinking about that... which seems like the best way of implementing that read-ahead idea of these options? And this is another question which is kind of subjective, but there's sort of pros and cons of a bunch of these strategies. And the question is, why did I choose 200? It is an arbitrary number. Because when you're implementing this in an OS, well, you're going to have to choose some numbers. Okay. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so people most like A. So the sort of the pro of A is that we're, you know, it's very likely that X plus 1 is needed. You know, it's extremely likely that that's useful to read in. Sort of the con is that versus other options, you know, we're waiting more often to load things. So I think that this is a very reasonable choice. You know, certainly, like, of all the choices, it is, like, you know, most likely that reading this in is useful, whereas other things might read in other things which maybe aren't so useful. Our second most popular option is D. And sort of the pro here is that we're reading in more that's likely to be useful. Useful. We're reading in 200 pages, and that's, you know, like a couple meg. So it's like it's a significant amount, but it's not so much that, you know, we're going to worry about running out of memory in the common case. And if we compare it to C, sort of a con is that we have extra page faults later, but a pro is that we will detect if the program keeps reading. So what I would think about for D is that if the program accesses page X plus 1, we'll bring in X plus 201, then X plus 202 with that strategy. This idea of not placing the pages in the page table right away will give us a way of detecting to keep reading further ahead of the program. So we always stay ahead. Whereas with C, we have less page faults. But the con is that, you know, the program might wait to look. Program might need to wait to load page X plus 201, which could be avoided in D. So questions about my sort of pros cons here? So by say reading, I mean moving from disk to a physical page. Yes, that is my intention here, is that this is loading into a physical page, regardless of whether we've loaded it in the page table yet, but yeah, loading it into physical memory. Okay. So this read-ahead idea, like, this is a big win, especially for these scanning patterns. There's other places where we can also be proactive that OSs do in practice. So one thing is that I sort of showed us doing all of page replacement when we need to load something, but often OSs will kind of do some of the work in advance where they'll free up a page so it's available for replacement without needing to worry about, oh, I need to save that data somewhere. They'll just clear out the page in advance. And this can include also writing out dirty pages in advance to save time writing later. Also, kind of maybe more importantly, to make it so if you have a power failure, you don't have all your data be lost because it wasn't written out. So these are other ways where we don't do that, where we might deliberately not do things on demand, where we'll just anticipate things, and usually it's a big win. So that's sort of what I have on sort of page cache and replacement, sort of, I guess. We didn't actually talk about working sets, but sort of the LRU model is what we talked about this semester. Working set is something you might see in the textbook, which is kind of a very related concept to LRU. And usually leads to the same conclusions. Okay, so questions about page caches. Okay, so our next topic, we're going to talk a bit, get into file systems, but first I need to talk about how we talk to devices. So I kind of gave this idea that we can read things from disk. We're going to look at, well, how do we actually communicate with things like the disk and the keyboard? And to talk about that, we need to talk about sort of, you know, something we kind of alluded to earlier, and I think I skipped over this, so it's not. Which is how, let's say, keyboard input works. And we saw a bit of this in when we looked at how system calls and exceptions worked. So let's sort of look at that. So when a key press happens, you know, that triggers a read, and an exception handler in the OS runs, trap runs, and it records the key press typically in a buffer. We don't actually send it immediately to the program. And later on, the program makes a read system call, and most commonly we satisfy it via the buffer. Now, if the buffer doesn't have input yet for the program, well, we're going to wait until that exception happens, and then we're going to satisfy it again from the buffer. So this key idea here is we have this buffer here where the OS stores data that it's gotten from the device, the keyboard in this case, that hasn't been sent to the program yet. And the same is going to hold true for talking to hard drives. That if we say read a character from a file, well, what the OS is going to do is it's going to read data from the disk into a buffer. And this buffer we learned is part of the page cache. And then satisfy it via that buffer. And similarly, when we're writing something, let's say we're writing something to the network, we're going to have a buffer that holds the output. So the OS is going to have this buffer of output waiting to go on the network. And when there's some exception that happens that tells the OS the network's ready for data, it's actually going to send from that buffer. And similarly, if we write a character to a file, we're going to store it in a buffer. And this is actually going to be part of the page cache. And when the OS decides to actually write that to disk, it's going to write, you know, a page from the page cache or maybe more to the disk, communicating with the device at that time. And so our next topic is we're going to look at, well, how does this process of actually getting this data into this buffer work, and also telling the device, you know, about data in our buffer and sending it to the device work. And also, how do we make that work along with these program requests? So that's what we're going to look at next time. So that's where I'll stop today. So I'll take an example. Question, will the producer-consumer example be relevant here? So what we end up doing does indeed look kind of like producer-consumer, right? That we have this buffer in the middle. We're not going to have that same sort of synchronization typically, but yeah, it's the same pattern, kind of just by accident. And the same sort of reason for that pattern, which is that, well, the speed at which the program writes things and the speed at which the device writes things sort of are out of sync, and we need to have the OS fix that sort of inconsistency. Other questions before I sign off?